Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And hello, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us today for our free-for-all. I'd like to welcome everybody who is with us live to go ahead and join up in the chat room. Similar to another free forum that we've had before, Eagle One and I are just going to have a conversation here, but what we would like to do is to get you shy, retiring creatures to grab a phone, give us a call. We usually don't take calls, but if you feel the need to give us a piece of your mind or at least a little what for, grab the line, give us a call. The phone number is right there on the show page for this episode. However, if you have a little bit of performance anxiety or prefer to feed us your messages on the chat room, we'll be glad to take them there. Well, Eagle One, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
Well, because we kind of hit this subject a few times this week, and it's one thing I wanted to post on my blog, and I just didn't get around to it this week, is situation in Korea. And there was, Drudge linked to this article today. So I'm just going to pull a quote from it as a way of talking about it. It's from Jack Kelly over at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And obviously North Korea continues to bubble in the background and occasionally, lob 152-millimeter shells hither and yon. But he brings up a real good point here, and I think a lot of people have served with the Koreans and realize the South Koreans, hopefully. They're a very capable, very professional force to be reckoned with. And also they're employing a few thousand of my fellow Southerners in car assembly plants down here. But here's the quote from Jack Kelly, near the end of his article. He said, "Things have changed in the last 60 years. North Korea is the last truly communist nation left standing. Its ambitions are limited mainly to self-preservation. South Korea, which is more than twice the population of North Korea and more than 40 times the gross domestic product, is more than capable of defending herself." I think this administration does a pretty good job so far of letting the Koreans deal with Korea. But do you see a movement out there, kind of something I've been supporting for over a decade, that maybe it's time to not emphasize defending Korea much and let South Korea take it from here?
Yeah, I think that is a trend, and it certainly makes sense. They're a big enough. I mean, if we've done our job as their patron, then they should be ready and capable, and the North Koreans should know they're ready and capable. I think that the last thing I heard was that the president of South Korea was suggesting that if the North Koreans do one more thing, of course, you always get to that, I'm going to draw another line in the sand syndrome, but he said one more thing and we're not going to mess around. We're going to respond with shock and awe. So that makes sense. We should also acknowledge that we're kind of on the anniversary of the frozen Chosin effort of the Marine Corps as they advanced in a different direction on their way out of that mess.
Yeah, I don't. And obviously, people initially get that concern. The North Koreans are nuclear armed, and in theory, I guess they are. But it's one thing to have something and then having the capability of doing it. The Hermit Kingdom is what it is. It's kind of like a exchange I had on Facebook with a couple of people a couple weeks ago, because there's all these discussions about China. Is China, Germany of 100 years ago, Japan of the 1930s, or something like that? I'm like, no, actually, China is just China. I think it's very hard to compare them to something else, a nation with that much history. and that many, lack of a better phrase, scores to settle both internally and externally, and mouths to feed and economies to build up, I don't think there's a very good comparison. And I think in the Koreas, we have something else. North Korea, it's very strange. It's almost a medieval entity in that respect. And it, with each year, becomes more and more of an outlier on the curve. More and more, I don't think they're going to do anything but lash out like they've been doing, and ignoring them just may be the best way to go forward.
Well, they play this game, you know, the for years. I was kind of amused by the comment that they're the last communist country. I don't know what they are, I mean, other than a pure dictatorship. But they can't feed themselves. So every time they get into economic trouble, they have to blackmail the world into meeting their needs, and they always do it with some threat. I've been kind of surprised, I guess, that the succession effort of the youngster is responsible for some of the activity that's gone on with the sinking of the ROK ship and the shelling of that island up on the gosh, what's it called? Line of Death, whatever that line is.
Gulf of Sidra, Line of Death, DMZ. It all blends together after a while.
Yeah, it does.
The latest successor of the Kim dynasty, so to speak, I mean, that guy went to a boarding school in Switzerland that one of the guys I grew up with went to for a few years. He knows the West. He knows it well. He's obviously well-fed. It's just peculiar in the extreme. You know, where do they go from here? They're so painted into a corner, both economically and culturally and everything else. Yeah, any type of scenario, and I have to also continue to remind myself that in 1988, or better yet, just a few years earlier, go back to 1985, somebody told you what would happen to East and West Germany, they would have, you know, asked you what you've been smoking in Amsterdam. It's things can change what rather peculiar ways, but I think any type of post-North Korea, Korean Peninsula, is going to make the union of East Germany and West Germany that still has issues look like a walk in the park. It's when you see the video and the data coming out of that country, it's sometimes I think the South Koreans really don't want it.
Yeah, I can see why they wouldn't, and I think that they have such a challenge of trying to overcome 50 years of or 60 years now of propaganda, which has preached that everybody that's outside of North Korea is impure in some sense. That's a difficult effort to overcome. I was interested. I know I see that Commander Hendricks doesn't necessarily agree with the idea that the South Koreans want to take over the operations necessary to defend themselves, but I don't know what else we're going to do about it. We don't really, you know, other than offering support, I don't think we really want to go popping in there. I see that Brian McGrath wrote a piece on information dissemination about where Robert Kaplan has urged that we go to more offshore military power, that we have to build and maintain a strong Navy. Given that we're still plugging away on the LCS and other things, what do you see we're doing right now?
Funny you should mention that. I actually have a post scheduled on my home blog to go up tomorrow on that. Same thing by Kaplan. I think broadly, I agree with Kaplan in a large sense. And it's something, you know, going back to the comment I made about Korea, and I was way off the reservation 10 years ago, and I'm still off the reservation in this respect. And you've heard me give this speech before. I won't go into details about I believe in a thorough decoupling of us from a military concept. I like what we've been doing in Europe. We need to do more of it. But I think when you look at the economic reality going forward, but also just from a plain point of view of common sense of the way the world has changed and moved forward, that there's no reason why nations such as Korea, Japan, various nations of European Union should have such a large portion of their defense and indeed be garrisoned by the armed forces of the world's debtor nation, largest debtor nation. I think some joint combined logistic and training bases, maybe in Poland, Romania, keep maybe one in Germany, or at least the ski facilities in Garmisch would be nice. And you can then decouple from South Korea and Japan. I understand the discussions in, about needing as much forward deployed in Japan as possible. I think there's also an argument to be made that the Cold War and World War II is over and that maybe we shouldn't be doing that. I think I largely agree with Kaplan's plan. And if you want, and that's just, believe it or not, because I have no skin in this game from a monetary point of view. I don't work for any company in any way, shape, or form associated with these various arguments. But it does lend well into what the whole land-sea concept for defense, which I think is right for a island nation with global reach. It's a maritime mercantile republic. There's nothing shameful or wrong with saying we're going to speak softly but carry a big stick, but we're not going to have the imperial decorations that go along with it. If we need to reach out and help somebody, then we should build a force that has the expeditionary capability to do so. We should have global reach by sea and in the air. Again, we need that follow-on bomber. I think that's an absolutely essential thing. And I also think as part of a reset, we should go back to what this nation did for most of its history, and this isn't a very popular thing to say, but the balance of our ground forces should be in the reserve and the National Guard, which gives us the capability to bring them back up if needed. We do not need a large standing army in the second decade of the 21st century. It would be nice to be able to build one if we could, but we don't need a large standing army in that respect. What this nation should have is the ability to have a global reach, and you just naturally do that via the air and the sea, and it also needs the ability to project power, whether it's kicking in the door and holding till the larger, ugly, and heavier come along, or you're in a situation where you need to do a punitive expedition of some kind or a small operation in conjunction with allies. That is predominantly a Marine Corps mission, but I also see the Army, their air mobile divisions, and whether you talk about the 173rd, the 82nd, the 101st, and a couple of other rapidly deployable units that are on active duty, I think would fit that bill really well. We don't need to be involved in a land war in Asia, boom, 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 and I just don't see from either a monetary or a larger strategic goal why at 2010 the U.S. military needs to be arraigned like an empire. I just don't see it.
Yeah, I'm less inclined to diminish the Army much more. I think we can get out of some places where we have relatively large forces deployed, but it's really hard when you're, if you do get involved, to get your people back up to speed if they're used to a certain operating tempo. And, you know, I'll go back to my days at sea that if you deploy back-to-back, you know, 11 months, 4 months in the States, that 7-month deployment, most of your crew was still on board and they were all pretty adept at what you were doing. You didn't lose much in operations tempo. But if you had a major shipyard period, a couple of years, you know, a year out of sync, then when you went back out to sea, you might as well have had to reinvent the wheel a lot of times. It was very difficult to get everybody back up to speed. And I assume with ground combat that's the case, too. Although I'm willing to invite anybody who knows more about ground combat than I, which would be pretty much anyone, to let me know if my thinking is off base on that.
Well, you look at the U.S. forces that eventually got, and there were hiccups along the way, that got ramped up for World War I, got ramped up for World War II. A lot of those were drawn from Guard and Reserve forces. And and I think there's lots of different ways that you can cut this into different pieces and how you define a large standing army and how you view the world. I mean, if you really believe that there is a case to be made that we need large standing forces deployed all over the globe, then fine, make that argument, but you have to make it not with blinkers on. And you have to look at it from a sense, are we doing it in a fair way? And here's what I mean by fair. For most of the last 65 years, we subsidized the defense of Europe, and we continue to today. When you have very prosperous, very strong, and I might add, very democratic and free countries, plus or minus a couple of details in Europe. Specifically, I'm talking about the Belgians and the Dutch spend well less. And I think in the Belgian case, it's even below 1% of GDP on the military. The French, the Germans, below 2%. Most of Eastern Europe, the former Warsaw Pact countries, are below 2% with a few exceptions. You have some nice countries like Estonia that are over 2%, but that's a population of 1.2 million. That's like Tampa Bay. And that's something that we need to keep in mind, something that we need to ponder, that are we having a fair share situation online? And we have a caller on the line. Did you have something you wanted to throw in there, Eagle One, or did you want to pull on our caller?
No, let's drag the caller in and let him carry the load for a while.
Hey,
Harry Code 703, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. This is Captain Hendricks calling. Been enjoying listening to this. Just to pick up where you were just a moment ago. Recently heard a speech by Admiral Stavridis, the Supreme Commander of Europe, talking about Afghanistan and talking about the European contribution about that. And he said that it was an ongoing goal of his to get everybody's contributions up above the 2% line. But he also wanted to point out that as a percentage of forces committed, Europe has been bearing a load in Afghanistan. In fact, their mortality and casualty rates are higher than our own as a percentage. Now, I found it interesting he wanted to point that out because there's a lot of criticism that goes to the European allies with regard to their contributions. But I was intrigued by the idea and didn't get a chance to follow up with him afterwards that he failed to tie in the fact that that their casualty rates are higher than ours because they haven't been investing in the type of protective equipment or sensors or, for that matter, offensive weapons as we have. And so they put their troops more at risk than perhaps we do when they're in a combat situation. Now, that being said, moving on to something you had said previously that I was originally calling in on, and that is that we are going to face, in the near term, like within the next budget cycle, a significant cutback. And when I mean significant, I'm saying somewhere in the 5 to 10% range, and numbers could go higher than that on outlays for our own defense budget. And so it is time, somewhat like our own internal, debt commission, that we're going to have to go and balance exactly where we can best spend our money. And I think some of the debate or the points that Sal's been putting out are useful in the sense of offshore balancing, the Air Force, the Navy, the air-sea battle construct that's out there is a viable way. And I think that's one of the reasons why the SecDef took an interest in it within the QDR is because he saw what's coming, and he wanted to move to position ourselves. Now, that's not to say that we, have to just gut the Army or, for that matter, gut the Marine Corps, but I do think that we will have to look at some manpower cuts in both of the ground services to be able to free up some cash for investment because we simply cannot take another decade of a procurement holiday like what we did in the 1990s after the last peace dividend.
And Jerry, I think you brought up something really good there. And SecDef Gates, we should all pray for his health every day.
Yeah.
But as we go through this, And, you know, you've heard me talk about the terrible 20s, even long term, but let's bring it inside to the next 5 years or so and some of these challenges. I think what's going to have to inform it and to make sure we do this smart, it's going to take leadership that has the ability to break this block, because I think if we do this, but we maintain the pie, it's like, okay, everybody's going to take a 15% haircut.
Yeah.
We are sub-optimizing what money we do have, because we need a strategy and a concept that's appropriate for this time and place in history and this country's economic and geopolitical stance relative to its friends, peers, and people who aren't as friendly. And I just hope that we have the leadership that will allow that type of forward and blunt thinking to be able to shape that pie better. And I always kind of use it, apologize. He was like, I know I'm a Navy guy, but I don't have a skin in this fight. I'm just trying to look at the world knowing we're not going to have as much money as we want. We'll be lucky if we have 75 cents on the dollar that we need. How do we best put it in place and do a little bit of risk mitigation? That's why I say, you know, okay, there are challenges with having reserve and guard with your ground forces. If you need them, it's nice to know that they're there. You know, what type of risk are you doing by having that at a lower fuse than you would otherwise? And it's really, really tough, Jerry. And who is waiting in the wings out there? I'm not expecting you to put out any names, but we need that depth of leadership, because one man's Seth Gates isn't going to be able to make it happen. It's going to be able to take the right players in the Senate and the right players in Congress in order to make that work.
I agree, and you know, I do. I won't say that I'm actually on my knees praying for the SecDef's health every night, but I certainly wish him well and have enjoyed him as the Secretary of Defense and the type of leadership that he's taken, both first trying to get things under control with Iraq and Afghanistan, and then within the last year as he seemed to have turned his focus back inside the department and looking at some of these issues, and he's begun to tee up a number of things that, you know, that are very insightful in the way that he's going. I know that he's indicated that he desires to go home, and that he might go home sometime, you know, next year. I'm hoping that if he goes home next year, it'll be on December 31st of 2011, rather than, you know, April the 1st or something like that. That being said, you're right in the sense that I'm not sure if everyone realizes that next year. Sorry, my computer.
You played with the kids' toys again, Jerry.
No, it's somebody just lit off on the computer. Anyways, I know that I hope everyone realizes that next year there's going to be a substantial turnover in the four-star ranks. We're going to have a number of COCOMs that are going to transfer and rotate. Of course, the chairman, the vice chairman, both rotate next year. And so you're right. It's going to be a huge issue on who we go to, and it's going to be a real indicator on the direction the secretary is heading. I actually, in my own internal prediction, it's nothing other than my own prediction, an opinion, is that Gates stays around long enough to get the reformers in place that he desires to be able to make the substantial changes in the services. I know General Casey goes home next year from Chief of Staff of the Army. CNO will change out next year. And so you'll see those type of those places, management by personnel. But, you know, it's interesting as you look at that, and I had a chance to sit down with somebody last week and kind of scan the three-star and four-star list, and I, this is just, again, my judgment, but the bench is not deep on reformers.
No.
And so, you know, I'm kind of interesting to see where things go. But I know Secretary Gates, the most interesting thing I saw was Gates' speech here in D.C. last year, where he started to talk about aircraft carriers. And you could feel the disturbance in the force when Alderaan got destroyed by the Death Star.
Yeah.
So, and if that's the indication of where he wants to go, then there's a really small group of people that he could tap to begin considering, you know, alternative futures that perhaps don't include supercarriers ad infinitum forever, especially supercarriers that are coming in at $13.8 billion, or essentially all of our shipbuilding budget.
Let me interrupt you there for a second, Captain Hendricks. Let me apologize for saying Commander earlier. Let's talk a little bit about what are the most important pieces of our fleet. I mean, everywhere I turn around, we're looking at people who are claiming that there's a shortfall. But it seems to me that of all the things we hardly ever mention, but which would be a problem for us in the long term unless you're looking down the road, is our logistics force. How are we going to get our fleet deployed if we don't have enough assets to support them and sustain them when they're in operation? Any thoughts along those lines? Any reformers that love mobile logistics like I do?
Well, I agree with you. And in fact, the one thing that we've seen in internal deliberations and in some of the scenarios that we play out is that, especially as we started the test air-sea battle, and I think Jan Van Tol in his report from CSBA earlier this year about air-sea battle highlighted the fact that when you start talking about operating not only dispersed naval strike groups, but also you start talking about dispersing the Air Force in some sort of an air-sea battle campaign, then we have nowhere near the oilers, ammo ships, et cetera, to be able to keep all those forces dispersed for over a long period of time. It's one of those areas that is a real force enabler. The problem we have and the problem that the people inside the building would say is, okay, great, but what do I do with those things in peacetime? We have a number of our oilers and support logistics ships that are in ready reserve in the various different places. But, you know, how do you keep that stressed and taxed and moving and trained? And of course, you know, not to talk about my own ideas too much, but, you know, going back, you know, to the influence squadron ideas that I've written about for the last couple of years, you know, I actually see the logistics support ships as having a critical role as motherships for the dispersed low-end ships that I would like to see us build, you know, smaller, cheaper, more numerous, to do engagement and influence operations in peacetime to head off some of these conflicts before they begin. That would also provide me with those ships in a ready status that if I have to ramp up and then, you know, increase my intensity and start to concentrate my high-end forces as we move into battle.
Jerry, on that note, let me ask you a question. See if this discussion has been brought up or what we could gain for it. I've always been an advocate of the fact that the unsexy from you're unsexy but critical is constantly getting left. And if I have one more person tell me, well, it's because they don't have a sponsor, I want to throttle them. People need to think beyond their own little rice bowl. But has there been a discussion about leveraging the Naval Reserve and to put a larger role in the Naval Reserve towards being able to have these sexy but essential ships that you might not need 365, but when the Navy experiences, which we will sometime in the future, it could be 1 year or it could be 40 years from now, when we experience the stress that the Army and the Marine Corps did from 2001 to 2004, that the Navy has that to be able to tap in and bring forward. Has there been that discussion about how the reserves could help with this?
Disappointingly, no. At least not any of the conversations that I've been involved in. And that's not to say that I've been involved in all of them, so there's always a possibility that it's out there. That being said, the conversation that the Navy's had during the 20 years of my career, and much of which overlapped your own, was that the service was becoming increasingly technical, and certainly Aegis and the emphasis on the Arleigh Burke class, moving away from the frigates, the Perrys, towards the Burkes, said that, look, this is not something that's a pickup game. But I think that we've just identified in the last 10 minutes some areas where a reserve force could come in to do things like logistical support or, for that matter, low-end presence operations with things like coastal patrol craft, offshore vessels, you know, OSVs or OPVs, and some of these other things that perhaps, you know, we're not buying the exquisite, and then to use your phrase, the Tiffany force that we seem to be moving to. There is an area there where we could make a better use of them, and that they would be in standby and something that we could grab in a hurry. Right now, The Army has had an experience over the last decade that the grab and a hurry force has not necessarily been to their benefit. Although those people have come on board, they came on board with a significant price to the states that they came from, and the Army, I think, has had to step back and rethink where it wants to go with its Guard and Ready Reserve in the future.
And, you know, about five years ago, we were beating the drum real heavy about, you know, why in God's green earth are the Army and the Marines doing our riverine work? It's like, oh, because we don't have, and we had to rebuild the riverine force. I received a couple of emails from some reservists who used to be with the last riverine squadrons that we had, that we got rid of in the 90s. And these had the same layout that our riverine forces had in Vietnam, from your small boats all the way up to monitors, not unlike what the riverine force is in Colombia right now, which is a very robust and diverse force and gives the ground commander access to a lot of different options. And I think, you know, and again, to go back to you, let's talk about you for a minute, but your concept of the influence squadrons, a lot of these forces would lend themselves to being in a reserve status, that when you need them, you can grab them, because it's one thing to activate a riverine or a riverine squadron, or to activate an oiler, compared to activating a guided missile Aegis destroyer.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, like I said, I think there's plenty of room. We are going to need some innovative thinking about as we move forward, especially as we get into a fiscally constrained environment. And, you know, moving towards, platforms that cost less, moving towards alternative personnel manning issues. I'll tell you the other, thing the elephant in the room, there's the phrase, that no one wants to talk about now, and yet the Secretary has kind of teed up a little bit, is looking at our medical system, higher deductible for us in TRICARE, especially for the retiree community. All these things are going to have to be teed up, and they're going to come up within the next year to 18 months of the budget cycle. And right now, I see the services, and I see all four of the services plus the Coast Guard on a day-to-day basis. We have the conversations in the office I work in, but I also pay a lot of attention to my own service, and I see them right now getting very much into a defensive bunker mentality of going to defend the status quo at all costs. And they won't be moved until they're forced to be moved. And that's going to make a very difficult conversation, because we really need a period of innovation right now, which, again, is why I'm very interested to see what the new leadership team is that rolls out over the next 12 months.
Eagle One?
Well, influence squadrons. I'm writing a post about the spread of piracy across the Indian Ocean, because there is no influence squadron. Apparently, I don't know what the Navy's out there are doing, but they don't seem to be taking the fight to the pirates and stopping from leaving their Somali coast. What is the likelihood, in your view, of ever seeing an influence squadron in the United States Navy?
I think it's a low likelihood. In all fairness, I mean, when I wrote the first article, Fords and Ferraris, 2 years ago, I did it as with the intention of starting an argument with the Navy, and then following it up this last year with another article this April in Proceedings, I wanted to kind of continue that, because right now I think we're all very comfortable. The Navy is very comfortable in where it's at. And it doesn't really want to have an internal debate. It doesn't want to have an external debate. It wants to defend the status quo. So I wanted to tee up a number of things that I thought should be discussed. But the likelihood of that, and I mean, I'm 22 years in, and I'm increasing in my cynicism on a daily basis, so I don't see much of a chance. That being said, I've been encouraged by the Secretary of the Defense's statements that he apparently is thinking about trying to find solutions. And, I've always thought that if I could just get in the room for about 15 minutes with him and say, hey, you want a new alternative? Well, here's one that I think would be successful, especially if he's willing to consider constraining the size of our carrier fleet as a means of freeing up both money and manpower. I mean, every one of those things is 4,200 people without the air wing, and it goes up with the air wing with it. there are a lot of bodies there that we could redistribute throughout the fleet. And the reason why it's important to me, you bring up piracy. Piracy is cropping up in areas where we're not. And as we have restricted ourselves and started to pull back from some of our presence operations, we're getting challenged with piracy. We're also getting challenged by other nations who wish to renegotiate the rules of the road so far as the international norms of the global commons that is the sea. And specifically, I'm talking about China right now, in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, and in the Yellow Sea, where they wish to interpret the extended economic zones as having more characteristics of sovereignty than what even UNCLOS recognizes. And as long as we're not there upholding the rule set that we've built over the last 60 years, then they feel free to reinterpret their or institute their own rule set. And the problem is, as long as we're not there to back up ourselves, some of the other regional partners and actors are looking around going, okay, well, that's, if the Americans aren't here, the only big dog that is here is the Chinese, and I guess we're going to have to go with them. So I think really that's the hidden message behind what's going on with North Korea, South Korea, Japan right now, is that there's a real trial as to who's going to be the influence there. So, you know, to get back to your original question, I don't think that influence squadrons will be here within the next few years. However, it wouldn't take much in means of, you know, making the argument to leadership that they're willing to listen for us to be able to move very swiftly. And I will tell you that if the Navy's next CNO is a real reformer, then influence squadrons could begin, you know, within the next 3 to 4 years.
You know, one silver lining here is one thing that history tells us is tough times and times of crisis can often be a great catalyst to making effective change. But in order to do that, you need the proper leadership. And one thing you find with complacent organizations is they do just what you outlined before. You have entrenched people that have their ego and their interest tied up in the status quo, and they will defend that until reality reaches a point that it's indefensible and you have a leader there that can kind of push that change to where it goes. And I think most people see what's coming up in the next 5 years. It's going to be a very cold water in the face type of wake up for everybody. And I think it's helpful, though the comparisons are inexact, but I think it's useful. The U.S. Navy, I think, can look back what has happened to the Royal Navy in the last 5 years. And a couple of the boldface items that stand out that people need to say is not beyond the realm of possibility that something just dramatic could happen as well. We saw in the Royal Navy where they completely got rid of their Maritime Patrol Aviation Force. They said, okay, bye-bye Nimrods. If y'all get the MR4 up and working, then maybe we'll let you bring it back. And oh, by the way, nobody's getting promoted to lieutenant commander, or captain for the next few years to save money. You know, those types of dramatic steps. And on the civilian side, you know, the new prime minister's government has announced that they're going to lay off, 500,000 government employees, and that's for a nation of almost 70 million. So you know how many that would be for our nation. So nobody wants to see a crisis, but if people can get the right ideas and the right ears and we have the right leadership, and something that I'm going to be watching, I know a lot of people are as well, is what happens next year to get the reformers in position. Because one thing a reformer is, usually, he's a thinker that has an open mind, and you're going to need a lot of open minds to hear some ideas to make that happen.
I would concur with that, and I will tell you the one thing that is innovative that I've looked at, I was taken aback by the British decision to essentially decommission and pull their last carrier offline. But I was encouraged by the idea that they're going to work together with the French for the next generation of aircraft and aircraft carriers and how they're going to move forward. The European nations, just by the size of their GDPs, simply cannot afford the type of budget and innovation that what we can in the United States. I mean, $18 trillion national economy is substantial. I mean, 3 to 4% of that for us is substantially more than 2% of essentially a $4 to $6 trillion economy, which is about the largest that you'll see in Europe. But if they actually begin to consolidate defense initiation, our defense projects, and so they can get some sort of a larger, you know, economies of scale, you know, there can be some interesting innovation that goes on over there so far as some high-end potential. But
like the A400 program, I know they had some trouble with it, but it's an interesting platform when you look at its potential.
It is, and I mean, of course, the idea of the British and French navies actually sailing together, I'm sure, is making Nelson spin in the tomb. But it is interesting, and it is an innovation that's kind of long overdue if they're going to, you know, maintain some credibility as a force.
Well, speaking of lack of credibility, let's talk about American shipbuilding for a minute. I was telling Sal before we started that the American Shipbuilding Association consists of six shipyards: Avondale, Bath, Electric Boat, Ingalls, NASSCO, and Newport News, all of which are owned by two major owners, General Dynamics and Northrop Grumman. You know, that, as Sal said before we got started, that's just not, a duopoly is not always a good thing, and rarely is a good thing. And we've ended up with some of these ships, like the LPD-17s, which seem to be man-made disasters. What are we doing with our shipbuilding? How can we get that right? And is there any chance at all that we could get some of these smaller shipyards or even some foreign shipyards to help us out in this situation?
Well, I would, you know, as I've said before, I think that engaging, you know, one of the reasons I like looking at riverine and offshore patrol vessels and other things is that it would actually allow us to expand our shipbuilding base. And I mentioned a couple, you know, other, you know, shipbuilding companies that we could bring online if we were willing to move beyond sort of the high-end combatant. And then once you get these companies and you get them going competitively, then there's perhaps the ability for them down the road to compete industrial, because I think getting things tied up into one or two companies to build your high-end force really doesn't give you much of a competition, nor does it give you much potential for innovation. So I was, you know, was very encouraged when Austal got involved with LCS. I really appreciate Austal's innovation with their offshore patrol vessel and what they're doing with the joint high-speed vessel, and would like to see us, you know, move more in that direction. That, however, and I'll state this very quickly about it because it's very controversial, we're going to need to get over the idea of survivability amongst the American fleet. USS Arizona had, you know, 18 inches of armor at the belt line, and she went down with, you know, over 1,000 men very quickly. You know, the United States will take the first blow in the next battle, the next great sea battle, and we will lose men. The idea that somehow we can build survivability to a degree that these ships will actually take whatever, you know, anyone can throw at them and come back, I think is somewhat ridiculous, and it raises the prices of our ships tremendously, and it also excludes new innovations that we might want to look at. I'm willing to look at ships that perhaps will be manned low enough such that when we inevitably will lose that ship, that will at least minimize the manpower that we would lose, but at the same time, I'd rather build more ships that I could strike back in the second wave than be limited to a few exquisite ones. So that being said, you know, I think that if we can look at our shipbuilding rules, we can expand the industrial base. And the other part of that, too, and I hate to say this, you know, but I am a political science major from long ago at Purdue. Getting a few more congressional delegations involved and interested in the shipbuilding budget process other than Maine and Mississippi, I think helps us in the long run.
Amen, amen, amen. That's one of the problems I always had with BRAC, is there are certain parts of the country, most notably the Northeast, that the military is so decamped from. Not that they're anti-military, but you have some of the members in Congress who just don't have the opportunity to think much about national security and what it takes to have an effective military, because they don't have any of it in their constituency, so they don't have to worry about it much. And that's always been a concern of mine. Let's shift over, if we could, for a second. First of all, Jerry, I know we're keeping a lot of your time. Or can we keep you for a little while longer?
Well, the two short blonde people that live in my house just pulled a whole rack of brownies out of the oven, so I will have to go here shortly.
Okay. Well, let me throw one more question at you.
And what's that address again?
We'll keep you for one more question. We can be kind of selfish this way. But we've been on a good roll, and I appreciate you calling in. But shifting over to the air side of the house, in the last week, the F-35 kind of broke above the ambient noise again with the, what do you mean I can't fit it in a COD, and the discussion of maintenance and how you're going to maintain that engine and move it around, what modifications you may be. But there's also been a lot of words recently about, you know, the British have changed their buy. They're not going to be getting the Marine Corps version of it. But when you really look at the pointy end of the stick when it comes to naval aviation, I think with the F-35, we really don't have a choice. The Hornet and even the Super Hornet is a derivative of a mid-1970s strike fighter that we just can't have Hornets forever. And we just somehow have to make this F-35 work. I do think, though, you brought up a point that if we can have a come-to-Jesus meeting about the number of air wings we do, we might be able to save some money. But what is your take on that whole discussion of the F-35, and do we really not have a choice?
Actually, I think we do have a choice. And let me be controversial and just for argument's sake. I'm not completely wedded to this idea yet, but it's something I'm kicking around in my head and I'm thinking about. I think F-35 is quickly becoming the LPD-17 of aviation, and we still haven't even gotten into, you know, beyond initial test phase, so we don't know what problems we're going to have there in the long run. I can see in my own mind a future where, or an alternative, where I simply... Now, counter to everybody else, I think we have to build the Marine version of the F-35, or we have to have something to replace the Harrier, just simply because we need to have that capability, and I see short decks as having a lot of versatility in the future over long decks. That being said, I could see a proposal where we don't pursue the carrier variant of the F-35. We extend the Hornet line, the EF line, to buy me another decade, 8 years to a decade, but then I take my cost savings, which is anywhere from $20 to $80 million per aircraft on a one-for-one basis between the carrier variant or the 35, depending on which estimate you look at, and I invest that in accelerating U-class, and I get me the unmanned future of naval aviation that all of us know is coming, and we seem to be dragging our feet towards. I know the CNO has made the statements, but I've yet to be convinced by N88 and the rest of the naval aviation community. I think we get out of the problem with the F-35, which, by the way, F-35 is a stealth fighter. It depends upon the skin of that aircraft being excessively clean and free of corrosion. And I refuse to believe that there's a naval aviation aircraft in the world that exists on an aircraft carrier flight deck that's going to be corrosion-free. And, you know, if it's not, then let's just say that its radar cross-section is going to go up. So I have a lot of problems with a lot of the givens and assumptions that we made with the 35, and I think that we could actually do ourselves a favor by extending the Hornet line, but really doubling down on U-class and trying to get to something that isn't limited by the bag of mush that sits in it and limits it to a 9G turn.
That is something I would love to see you give a 30-minute brief with a 45-minute follow-on over at Commander Naval Aviation Forces. That would be a good brief. Hey, Jerry, thanks, first of all, for calling in and letting us abuse some of your time. Knowing you a little bit, I do not want to get between you and a plate full of brownies.
Yep, I'm already there, actually.
Thanks a lot,
thanks,
Jerry.
Have
a great week.
You as well. Bye-bye.
And now that I'm officially hungry, I'd like to let some other people do a little bit of talking here, but they're disembodied and can't call back to us. If you'll indulge me here, we've covered a couple of times on the show, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And this week there is a very interesting exchange between Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Senator McCain, I wanted to bring up here if I can get my technology to work. First of all, we're going to have just about a minute and a half or so of Mullen and his opening remarks. Here we go.
My personal views on this issue remain unchanged. I'm convinced that repeal of the law governing Don't Ask, Don't Tell is the right thing to do. Back in February, when I testified to this sentiment, I also said that I believe the men and women of the armed forces could accommodate such a change, but I did not know it for a fact. Now I do. And so what was my personal opinion is now my professional opinion. Repeal of the law will not prove an unacceptable risk to military readiness. Unit cohesion will not suffer if our units are well led. And families will not encourage their loved ones to leave the service in droves. I do not discount for a moment the findings in the Johnson-Ham survey, which indicate resistance to repeal by those in the combat arms and irregular warfare communities. I do not find these concerns trivial or inconsequential, nor do I believe we can afford to ignore them. Given that this reluctance arises from the ranks of the very troops upon which much of the burden of these wars has fallen, we would do well to pay heed and to move forward in a deliberate and measured manner. Whatever risk there may be to repeal of this law, it is greatly mitigated by the thorough implementation plan included in the study. The time to carry out that plan and effective, inspirational leadership.
Eagle One, I hate to say it because I've had a couple of issues with what Admiral Mullen has said in the past, but I think his statement there is pretty close to being about what we've talked about here. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think that for whatever reasons, the sea services, with the exception of Marines, seem to have taken a look at this situation, and they know they need all the bodies they're willing to serve. And, you know, there are ways on a ship you can accommodate various interests, and I think also on your on shore bases. I think it's, you know, the message from the ground forces, the Army and the Marine, was different, and it's because their situation is completely different. I had the chance to watch Restrepo, hope everybody else did the other day, and you know, that lifestyle, that situation that those young men find themselves in is not one that encourages openness about all aspects of your life to the extent that I'm not sure that those young men would be comfortable in the circumstances that Admiral Mullen just addressed.
Yeah, and I think when he's talking about exceptional leadership there, what we're talking about is exceptional leadership coming from your NCOs and your junior officers. And I think that's why you see the difference in who's having issues and who isn't. Because let's be frank here, you know, you're a company commander. You've got other issues to worry about than telling Fred to get over Sam's predilections. Let's hear what Senator McCain here, a little more in a minute.
I remain concerned, as I have in the past, and as demonstrated in this study, that the closer we get to service members in combat, the more we encounter concerns about whether Don't Ask, Don't Tell should be repealed, and what impact that would have on the ability of these units to perform their mission. These views should not be considered lightly, especially considering how much combat our force is facing. Additionally, I am concerned about the impact of a rush to repeal when even this survey has found that such a significant number of our service members feel that it would negatively impact military effectiveness. As we move forward with our discussion on this matter, I hope that everyone will put aside political motives and agendas. I also hope that everyone on both sides will refrain from questioning people's integrity. Finally, I hope that everyone will recognize that this debate is focused on our military and its effectiveness, not on broader social issues being debated in our society at large. This is a complex and important issue that could have significant repercussions for our force, a force that is engaged in its 10th straight year of sustained combat, but a force that is performing exceptionally well. At this time, we should be inherently cautious about making any changes that would affect our military, and what changes we do make should be the product of careful and deliberate consideration. I'm not saying that this law should never change. I am simply saying that it may be premature to make such a change at this time and in this manner without further consideration of this report and further study of the issue by Congress. For of all the people we serve, one of our highest responsibilities is to the men and women of our armed services, especially those risking their lives in combat.
Two things that kind of popped out for me here, Eagle One. First of all, I think you noticed there's a reason Senator McCain emphasized integrity. When I mentioned earlier I had problems with Mullen, it's because early on in this discussion, he threw out integrity into it that I thought was wrong. And as most of the listeners here know, I'm in favor of repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I do like where I think we might have a consensus coming from Mullen and McCain here, that this, we need to take our time with this. It needs to be done properly in Congress. It doesn't need to be done in the courts. That we need to take our time with this. I had been worried recently that some of the more aggressive people were going to try to jam this through in the lame duck. This is going to be hard enough as it is. If it's done in a tricky way, it's going to make it even more difficult.
Yeah, I think we've, you know, I think it's been beaten to death at this point, but you know, it's one of those issues that politically, I guess the establishment has to deal with, and they're going to address it at some point. And you know, I'd like to kick it down the road a little longer. I don't, you know, for the most part, most young people I talk to and work with don't care, but there are situations in which I can see that it would be a problem, and I think those are being slighted if you just decide to make a blanket rule. But one of the things we did, you know, to shift the subject here, we did talk about the F-35 engine problem, and you've raised the issue of the COD, and I've raised the issue of the H-60 Sierra not able to carry as much internal cargo, all of which relates to fleet logistics support for new aircraft and just be able to do our job. Well, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. It's one of my little pet ponies that I try to keep hidden. Otherwise, it's all I would blog about. And I kind of touched on it a little bit with Jerry. It absolutely makes me apoplectic that we've gotten so parochial here that we can't get leaders that are willing to support the essential but the unsexy. I'm talking about medium and heavy lift helicopters. If we only take one thing away from Afghanistan, damn it, it's that is such a critical force multiplier and is directly related to making sure that more of our young men and women come back alive and reasonably intact. I don't care if they're unsexy, and Admiral Ulrich should be pinged on it in retirement for what he did. But damn it, let's get on board. Let's get our medium heavy lift programs back to what they need to do. And, you know, shift flag also, the common support aircraft. And I think this they also have a lot of uses and influence as well, I think. But I'll let other people argue that. We need a replacement for the COD. We also need an organic tanker that is not a fighter plane nipple-feeding another fighter plane. It's unsexy, it's essential, and if you do it right, they're really not that expensive. I would love to see much more advocacy on that, and there really are multi-use platforms.
Yeah, again, it's not one of those sexy issues, but when you're down the road trying to get all the pieces to work together, it's really nice if you actually are able to have the reach back and get the parts delivered where it's supposed to be, when it's supposed to be.
And unfortunately, hopefully there's something going on in the background about that, but I think what we're going to see over the next few years is people are going to really be sucking their teeth over the fact that the fat decade is gone, and who knows when it's going to come back as this nation tries to get hold of a monetary situation and a budgetary situation that you're not going to be able to get away from. And so the unsexy but essential, I'm afraid, unless leadership really pushes it, it's going to atrophy worse and worse, and it's just going to be a complete train wreck. If I could give a little selling of the soap a bit with our last 30 seconds, I hope everybody will join us next week. We're going to have kind of a book focus next week. For the first half hour, we're going to have Professor Bruce Fleming come on to discuss the military-civilian divide in the book he's written. And also, for those who have seen it on my home blog, we're going to have Professor Rubel on to discuss his book selections for Christmas and his experience recently working with the Chinese. So thank you very much. Have a great Navy Day, Eagle One. You got anything?
No, I hope everybody has a good week, and we'll see you next weekend.
Thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate it.
Goddamn.